tell you something. You got the Bob Charles Show right over here. And you know what? We did have a little problem there getting through to England, but that's okay. I think he's on here now. I think Richard's on here now. Let me tell you a little bit quick about Richard and that, sort of we're still running around here. Richard is the author of Echoes from the Chamber, has lived a lifetime of profound supernormal experiences which opened his mind to a memory of how matter functions up to and beyond quantum. He offers his knowledge of how life, the universe, and everything functions and shows how his case, this awakening, was in preparation for a task of discovery he would conduct along with his twin flame in Giza, Egypt. Let me, right now, introduce Richard Gabriel. Hey, Rich, how you doing?
Hi there, Bob. Finally, we got past all the sound check problems.
That was my director you were talking to. I'm telling you, we were sitting here in the studio saying, there's got to be something going on over there. But that's okay. Don't worry about it. We're okay now. We're up and we're doing our thing and everything. Now, let's get the minds going here because I want everybody out there. And actually, Australia has already given me message in that coming in that says maybe it's the mic, maybe it's no sound, maybe the ears. I don't know. They're going crazy down there. They love you. Anyway, let's get back to the other thing that I've had on my blog and that all week. And I'm telling you, I've been getting emails left and right about this. And I keep telling everybody, hey, listen on the weekend because I can't tell you everything about the book yet. You know, I mean, it's one of those things. It's the echoes from the chamber is about secret Egypt and afterlife.
Yes, uncovered. That's right. Yes.
And the thing that a lot of people don't understand, and of course, we're getting into our time right now in time of awareness or knowledge. Things that we're getting from places all over the place now, like the world, our minds, our bodies, our spirits, they're all waking up.
Yep, that's right.
In your book, and from the parts that I did read, and of course I've read over the whole website too, and I mean that was extensive, believe me. But out of all of that, you go into this, I mean you go into this in depth.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, the title of the book, Echoes from the Chamber, it's a bit of a play on words. I mean, there is a direct correlation because the third part is a three-part book in one. The third part does deal specifically with Egypt, our adventures there, and everything up to date. But the preceding two parts really are a play on Echoes from the Chamber, although the whole book represents Echoes from the Chamber. The first two parts of it chart the story really from birth through in the preparation for the things that were waiting for us in Egypt and for the things that we're still involved in. So it isn't a deception, but it is a bit of a curveball. If anybody picks the book up and thinks it's just to do with Egypt, in a way it is, but it's to try and explain from our perspective and our experience what our journey meant and how someone reading it might find sustenance in it for their own journey. I know that convictions aren't transferable. You know, they're based on a person's own tested experience. But as we listen between ourselves, between each other, to each other's experiences, there are things that we can all draw from each other. And I hope as I read other people's experiences, I never close my mind to them and anything I might still learn. But by the same token, this book really is my duty, as I feel it, to pass on the depth of the experience which led us to the incredible things that have happened to us, which, as I said in my little notes to you before, comes under the heading of you couldn't make it up, really. Childhood was very extraordinary. Many things I was told about myself as a very small child, as a baby child, I learned later, my father has passed now to spirit, but he shared with me before he passed that I was recorded under sort of strange timing circumstances of birth. I'd already been told that, as they say in Scotland, born with a caul. For numerologists out there, my time he told me was recorded at Bertha's 13th minute, 13th hour, Friday 13th, so whatever that means, for whatever it's worth, that's for others to determine. But wow. during childhood, I did feel weird. You know, they say children often feel as if they're singled in some way. Like many people go through that experience. But there were really, really strange things that went through my head as a child that took me all of 30 years really to come to terms with when I had a life-changing experience that finally brought all the understandings together. And that was a very profound experience. It happened while I was working in Berlin and Germany for a time. But through childhood, the quest was to try to understand what those things were. And it sort of labeled me a little bit of a weirdo, an outcast amongst friends, because people were a little bit wary or scared or thought that it was strange, the things that I would come out with, sort of precognitive things. I used to have all the whole sort of list of things, stereotypical things that go with this subject, out-of-body experiences. I used to have precognitions, weird things happened around me. You know, I detailed loads and loads of these in the book, you know, party pieces that the other kids used to love on the school bus at home, turning people's heads and so on. Others can do that as well, so what? But I seem to have an innate ability to sort of tap into all of these things.
You know, I do have a question, though, from Australia for you. It said, hey, Bob, ask Richard if the message from the past was all about the time of no times to come soon.
Well, yes. I mean, I obviously have to read between the lines of that question a little bit, but I believe that all that we need to know for the future is already there in the past. And I think that the message from the past has been hidden in plain sight all along in front of us. And I think that the last couple of thousand years in particular of conditioning, social conditioning, has helped to turn us into sheeple, helped to blind us to the information that is there in plain sight. And I think it's been controlled that way. It's a controlled conditioning, and it's kept us from the truth. And now that people are becoming more awakened and starting to follow the audit trails to these wonderful things in the world and these wonderful sights around the world, and start to understand about our Earth energies, galactic energies, and the constructions on Earth that archaeology conveniently sidesteps, as people come to terms with those and people start to physically examine these things and become aware of them, I think that the conditioning is starting to fall away and people's eyes and minds are starting to be opened to the reality of these things and the messages that are waiting in abundance to tell us. I mean, I could dive in here and spend an hour just going through examples of this around the world that are in the forefront now. There is a raising of consciousness, of course there is, you know, and one says that one can say that, okay, 2012 wasn't the big
bang
fireworks display that everybody thought it was going to be.
Right.
But I think everybody would have to be blind to not admit that through the period of 2012, there has been a colossal change in consciousness, in values, in social structures, institutionalized structures throughout the whole world, and it's going on now. It's accelerating, in fact, and it's taking place right at this moment. So the 2012 pass-through has come and gone. I have to say, by the way, that although 2012 became fashionable with the internet as we drew close to it, and I wasn't silent myself in saying enough about it, but 30 years ago, when I had my experience, I was given to understand that as we passed through, not 2012, but through 2011, that a huge change in consciousness would take place. And, okay, it may not be the stuff of books and things that have appeared by the thousands, by the bucketful across the world, but it was part of my own private journey and understanding, or it was part of my journey to understand what that meant, how it applied to me and laterally to my twin flame research partner, Judith, as we came together again and continued to experience the incredible things that we have experienced over Egypt and make the discoveries that we've been privileged to be able to make over there.
You know, the funny thing is, Richard, when you talk about Egypt, there were so many things that so many people thought that archaeology was the art of growing or of digging something up, and just finding something old. And do you ever notice that lately, no matter where you read, no matter where you look, no matter what show that you ever listen to, they're talking about a lot of things, quantum physics. They're talking about geometry. They're talking about math. They're talking about pi. They're talking about things that never were connected to an archaeology expedition before.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, I have to say, jumping back to my own and understanding as it came to me for this, I mentioned a little while ago that it's not convictions aren't transferable as such. All you can do is consider them, run anything new through your own experience, test it against your own experience, and come to your own conclusions. That's why I might speak in the first person singular and speak very definitely about my experiences and understanding of everything. But I say time and time and time again, look, take everything I say as complete nonsense, if you will. That's fine. But take it and adjust it against your own experience, test it against your own experience. Now, having said that, I have to tell you that a person only ever needs to have one full out-of-body experience. You'll never, ever again in your life believe that there is nothing beyond physical life.
Oh, yeah, I know. I had one of those myself.
Once. I can't transfer that to somebody who hasn't had one.
Yeah,
all
you
I can
can't.
Say is that I talk in complete sincerity. I can tell you that we've had many, many, many out-of-body experiences which have shown us things which we have subsequently gone to Egypt, found ourselves in places where we hadn't planned to go, and found validations for those experiences. So within ourselves, within our own conviction, we are absolutely, as day and night exist, we are completely sure of ourselves and the ground that we stand on. That's why I say also in writings, that, and in the book, of course, that we welcome all comers. Any question on any of the awkward questions. You find people talking on a spiritual level and you get these very sort of stay questions. If it's all as it is, why do babies die young? Shh. And why do the good people seem to get it in the neck more than the bad people? Shh. Mm. Well, you know, I say openly, look, bring it on. Bring the whole lot on. Because any question that anybody has to pose, I can assure you that when I had my memory recall event for the week afterwards, when I feigned illness from work for a week, I went through every single question that I could possibly invent in my brain to throw against it, to test it against what I knew and understood myself. And that process still goes on today. So, you know, if there's a truth and an understanding out there and it's the real deal, it has to be able to withstand any test, any question that's thrown at it. You can't shy away from the awkward questions. And it's the same with archaeology. Archaeology, under the control of the controllers, have shied away and steered everybody away. And now, where people are actively going out to places, they are physically closing down the audit trails where people may be able to uncover truth that's hidden in plain sight that would give us a complete paradigm shift in thought as to what our true ancient ancestry is. And that's what we're all about. That is our mission. It is to track that down, to follow the pathway of strongest probability that's been laid for us, and to see what comes out of it. We go to Egypt every time. We go there wishing for everything, expecting nothing. And it always happens.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know what was really, really funny on the, I don't know whether it was Egypt but or another place, or whether it was, it could have been Peru. Yeah, that it was. They found a on the inside of an archaeology dig, they found a carving of a helix. And it was really, really funny because like 2 months later, somebody or something put one in a cornfield.
Mm-hmm.
The same one. Now, how many millions of years are there between one and the other? You know, I mean, that, these kind of things in that are too, that's what I mean by learning things. I mean, if you, what people listening to this show and that should do, and they read your book, for instance, I mean, that's one of the best, is connect the dots.
Yes, that's all, connect the dots for themselves. It's possible to do that, yes.
They're all there. All you got to do is connect them.
That's absolutely right. They are there. They're all there in plain sight. I have to say that probably to understand the background of the book, it's far easier to start at the end part and work backwards from the back to the front. And as far as Egypt's concerned, we found ourselves out in Egypt. We found very strange things happening, people appearing to us, apparent strangers saying they were expecting us, saying they were there to show us something. And it went way beyond the normal touts wanting to show us some things that they wanted to sell. No, instead, they actually did take us places and did show us things that tourists don't see that absolutely blew our minds. The wow factor is there every time. I remember on one occasion walking down through one area where a guy had intercepted us as we were walking around the back by Menkaure. We'd had an incredible that day anyway, because a Bedouin had sort of intercepted us as we were walking up into the pyramid complex from the Great Pyramid end. And he beckoned us to the side, tall, very tall guy, dressed in a brown robe, and pulled us off the path where all the tourists were back, coming backwards and forwards under strict guard. And nobody stopped us, and he sent us into the mastaba fields just behind there and told us, go ahead, look, nobody will touch you, nobody will bother you. And we spent half a day in there, and that's a story and adventure on its own, which is in the book. But when we came out of there, there were a couple of things that happened actually on the way as we made our way towards Menkaure. The experience had been absolutely incredible. But as we came around the back road down the path beside Menkaure, this guy approached us, a short guy, and he spoke in good English and said, "Ah, I've been waiting for you." And we were astonished. The wow factor again, hairs go up, and you think, oh, here we go again. Go with the flow and see what happens. Well, we ended up being taken by him through the barbed wire area that was there at the time where Mark Lehner was working, into a restricted area. And he took us inside, and we were actually taken down through, no questions asked, no explanations, anything. He was gibbering away with information all the time. Took us down three levels, and we saw tunnels running from rough cut and shafts as we looked down through of immense depth. That were cut as clean, as sharp as a razor, but they were a little deeper underground to get to those. And when we came up from there, we were introduced to, we know who the person is now, we were introduced to the police chief. The guy looked as if all the time we were thinking, we're going to be stopped, we're going to be stopped, even though we were enjoying what was happening and taking it all in. I said to Judith behind me, I said, take pictures, take pictures. I just want to keep talking. And she was snapping away, and I had to keep turning to her and say, Judith, you can't keep saying wow. Stop saying wow, wow, wow.
Yeah, right.
And I had to quieten her, and she was smiling back at me and just carrying on taking pictures, and that was fine. But when we met the police chief, our host, he walked over a couple of paces to him, and they were talking away in Arabic. And with that, the gentleman in question, if I described him, then half the listeners who've been to Egypt would know exactly who I'm speaking about, but I'll spare that for now. He took a couple of paces over, extended his hand, shook my hand, and shook Judith's hand and said, enjoy yourself. And we were away with him again, and he took us to show us other things, many other things in that area. But while we were talking with him, and we were still trying to say, probe us to, how do you know us? And he said, you know our son, my son. And what, how do you mean your son? And he said, yes, your son, you met him. And something, a little light went off in my head. And the previous day, maybe in the previous day or a couple of days before, we'd been over at the old police station as you come in. It's all been redeveloped there now, at the Great Pyramid end of the complex. We'd come in through there, and we'd been over at the police station there talking with them. And one of the guys that we'd spoken to was actually a plainclothes police, special policeman, guard for Zahi at the time.
Wow.
And he'd pulled us to one side and was chatting with us. And we hit it off with him. You know, he was a really good chap, and he was talking about many things, and we shared a lot of information with him. And that was that. But he referred to that his son worked with the police, and the light went off in my head. I thought, hang on a minute. We'd been to the, what was the Kodak shop down there now, in the Sphinx Square, and we didn't have the digital camera that I have now. And just for safety, we got pictures developed straight away. We always used to do it coming off the plateau. put them straight in there, got them developed, and got them out of there. And I had a few photographs in my pocket. I'd sifted out a few key photographs of people that we'd met in case we bumped into them again, just to remind us. And I fished in my pocket, and I pulled out, and the top photograph I pulled out, there was the group of us posing together with the all the police at the police station there, and the administration office. And he said, "Yeah, there." He said, "That's my son," and it was the guy I'm talking about. That was his son, and there was that was it. That was sufficient. Needed to know no more. That was enough. And he continued to take us on our way. And late that afternoon, we actually had an appointment with a senior person of the Coptic Church, which was to pay our respects and thank the person concerned for help given previously on another extraordinary adventure out in the Western Desert. And he'd taken us down the pathway leading back to the Sphinx Square. We'd gone a little bit of the way. He said, you got time now? He said, I'll show you where the tunnel is, where you go underneath to go where the boats go. And I put two and two together, and I thought, hang on a minute, is this where we're talking about, where the story of Jim Hurtak and the film, the movie was taken down below? And I had a quick word with Judith as we were walking. I said, "Oh my Lord, he's referring to that, for goodness sake. We really, of course, we'd like to be taken." He said, "I'll show you." He said, "I'll take you, show you." And then a sort of call of duty came to us, you know, we have to go. We love the person concerned. We have to meet our appointment, which was on the other side of Cairo. We explained to him, and he said, "No, I understand. You have no need to worry," he said, "because you will be back here, and I will meet you again." And that's a few years now, 2, 3, 4 years perhaps. And I've no doubt that we will meet him again. But it was just one other day of, from start to finish, of crazy things happening. Our heads were reeling by the time we got back home. It's no less incredible than the day that we met the god on another site local to the pyramids, which tourists don't usually go to. We knew about it because we knew of the energies emanating from this place. I'm being guarded about it, but you'll understand when I explain the story. While we're there, we wanted to go and see a particular man that we'd heard a lot about. He'd been some 40 years, wow, at this station, guarding this place. He was the keeper there, the watcher, the keeper.
Holy mackerel.
Little spindly guy. And the place he stayed in up there was no bigger than a garden shed. And on high ground. Anyway, we were taken there by trusted people in uniform. It wasn't certain whether we'd be able to either see him, speak to him, or actually visit the place. But nonetheless, they took us in the back way, and we sort of made it there completely blind from the tourist sections. And one of them went ahead, and we could see him up on the hill, talking with him. The arms were flailing on both sides, and they could hear voices raised. And I thought, "Oh my Lord, there's an eruption here." But the one that was the other host that was with us calmed us down, said, "No, it's okay. He's always like this. It's okay. He's good. He's a friend of his. Let it go. Let it go." Then after a while, they seemed to calm down a little bit, and we saw arms beckoning us up the hill. So the horses were left at the bottom, and we walked up the hill. Anyway, we were given space to, inverted commas, say, meditate. Of course, our purpose there wasn't to meditate. Our purpose was to learn. And I felt drawn to that place and to this man anyway. So while we were sitting there at a very deep open shaft, the guy in question, the keeper, was having a continued word with the man who'd taken us, one of the two. And I thought, no, I can't leave it at this. So I just up and walked straight over to them. And they stopped their conversation, and I asked for the guy to translate, to ask a question. I can't even remember what the question was, but I must have said the right thing or whatever, because he, in a calm voice, he spoke to him, and he translated back and answered it. And I asked, would he mind if I asked him a few questions? I gave him great respect, and he allowed me to speak with him, with the translating going backwards and forwards, and the questions and the answers got deeper and deeper and deeper, until it got to a point where we were talking even beyond the tunnel network below ground, and we learned a lot more about that and where the tunnels lay and how they traversed and so on, and various things about them. And I wanted to ask him what to me was a sort of holy grail question, a question of rumor, but I just wanted to see what his reaction was. And I knew I would have to lead into it as well. So I gibbered on a little bit, and I said, look, I said, what I'd like to ask at the end of this, there's been many people have talked about if there were people from before who were ancient to the Egyptians, who sought refuge below ground at a time of catastrophe, that it is rumored and said that there are those who remain behind in a place that was livable below ground, words to that effect, but that was the question. And I'd taken quite a long time, sort of drawn it out. And I said to my friend who was translating, I'm sorry to give you so much, I said, but can you elaborate and explain to him, you know, where I'm coming from with this and why I've asked it? I didn't want to offend him. And he started to speak to him, but the guy, he held his hand up to him, stopped him. He said, in Arabic, I couldn't understand. And the guy in uniform who was helping us, his face took, he was shocked. He had a shocked look on his face. And I said to him, what's the matter? And I was afraid that the worst had happened. And he said, you have no need to fear. He said, he's told me he understands everything that you've been asking. And then I was, the wow factor again hit me. And I said, you mean he actually understands what I'm asking? He said, yes, yes. He said, what does he say? And he went back to speak to him again. And he was gibbering away in Arabic again. He came back to me and he said, he told me to tell you that, yes, those are his friends. Sometimes he goes to them. Sometimes they come to him.
Wow.
Not very often, but sometimes he sees them. Sometimes they come to him. He says, why do you think nobody else comes here? He said, why do you think everybody is scared to be here? So I continued, and the conversation went on for a little while. I was asking questions in English. He wasn't translating, but the guy was giving the answers back in Arabic, and that had to be translated to me.
Oh, boy. So in other words, he was, I mean, this was through telepathic means in one way or another.
However, he knew, and he was answering specifically questions and things I was speaking about.
Or thinking of.
Yeah, I was thinking of. It was absolutely astonishing. We made good friends with him. We've seen him, you know, in occasion since, and we look forward to seeing him again. Lovely, lovely, lovely man. A very special spiritual man, a genuine watcher. And I know that he's not alone, or Judith and I both know he's not alone. You know, we've met many people on the plateau who just appear. If you're meant to be there and it's the right time, right place, and it's meant to be that information is supposed to come out and you are a vehicle for it, then that's what happens. And the same thing is true for NC2. And a lot of humbug's been written about NC2, but it's all very mundane. It's all very simple. And I break it down when I'm talking to people about it, just to explain. NC2 is a designation name. It's Northcliffe 2. It's the name that was given in George Reisner's time for tombs that were being opened on the cliff facing from the back end of the plateau, beyond the three pyramids, where tourists normally do not go. Behind the middle pyramid, let's make it easy and call it that, little way up the hill is a helicopter pad. They got the road in part production from when Zahi Hawass was in power, where they were doing the plateau redevelopment project. And I can come on to that if I have time later with regards to the animals and what's happening to them there. And then beyond that, high on the skyline is the Harvard building, Harvard University building, the home of George Reisner for many years. But you go back a couple hundred years and there was exploration going on around there and from there. And NC2 is a tomb that was uncovered very close to the Harvard building. And upon entering that tomb, in fact, up until recently, it would have been difficult to enter it because the sand was filling it up to about two-thirds the height of its doorway. Whoa. And the sand filled down inside. It blocked the passage right and left which when cleaned out gave way to stone steps down into subchambers either side, and also obstructed to be able to get deeper into the front tomb section. Now, it's already been determined that that was used in the worship of birds at one time, and it's sort of been colloquially called the Tomb of the Birds. It was rediscovered as something of much greater importance by Andrew Collins, who had been researching the British Library's publication of the works from a couple hundred years of Giovanni Gaviglia and Henry Salt. And they had explored this tomb and had found, or had described in their notes recently published, that there was a way into the plateau from there, into natural tombs and chambers. And there's a key passage in their report which describes them going through a forced passage deep within the plateau into continuing chambers and so on. Now, they didn't have the benefit of flashlights and modern equipment, so one has to picture what it would have been like for them at the time. And the description that they gave in their account fits with what one would have imagined. Pretty hellish. It's pretty dangerous in there. There are dangerous insects and so on. Back in the day, there have been dangerous animals using it also. And Andrew Collins was able to uncover the fact of this and finally located it with Nigel Skinner-Simpson, located that entrance. Now, we found a way there, coincidentally, around the same time, but by separate means. Again, it was by fantastic means on the day. We were on the last day of a stay there. We were just going up on the plateau to relax for a few hours before we left on the aircraft. And Judith urged me, actually. Again, it was an instinctive thing, and I've learned not to distrust her instincts, which are as sharp as a razor. She said, come on, we need to go and see if we can find the entrance. And we're going to get stopped, and I had objections. We haven't got time, and so on.
Yeah, right.
And she urged me on, said, oh, come on then, okay. So off we went, and 10, 15 minutes later, nobody had stopped us. And we found ourselves, bang, there we were. We knew we were at the entrance to NC2. And then we went, and we found the crack at the back that led into the tunnel system, and that was our first visit there, taking loads of photographs right down through to as deep as it could go at the time, about 350 feet. Now, since that time, I've been in there so many times, hours and hours and hours and hours, touching nothing, specifically to say that, touching nothing, simply recording, observing, measuring. As a result, I've been able to produce a schematic, which is on the site of the subchambers and the system generally, first accurate one showing the layout of it all. And from the photographs being brought out, and the investigation of those, that's really where the discovery process began. Because at the time, there was a lot of controversy because Zaihawas was denying the existence of the system. And there was a backwards and forwards, which was very public and unsavory, where Zahi was basically calling Andrew a liar, and eventually it was Zahi who was proved to be deceitful because he produced a television production called Chasing Mummies, where he and a film crew went in there ostensibly to prove that the pyramid idiots were idiots and that there was nothing there of any importance or such like.
Now,
even on the stills of that film, I've been able to freeze that and go into the stills of that film and actually show things that were in the backgrounds there that they breached over. It was a complete deceit. It was disgraceful. But in any event, the result of that was that Zahi had a couple of teams, official secret teams, go in there. Now, I'd taken loads of photographs in there with Judith's help, and on a subsequent visit, I remember I was reduced to tears in there because I was able to see immediately that all of the things, the larger things that were laying about, items of metal, precious possibly, that I'd recorded.